room to dampen your enthusiasm for one another. Not really. I'm really delighted and honored that we got as a speaker tonight for our keynote address, Michael Pack, somebody whose name may be known to many of you more for his political experiences, his time on the cross in recent years, than for his work as a documentary filmmaker. But that's the latter is mainly what we wanted him to talk about tonight, because as a filmmaker, he's a maker of culture. And that's really what we want to be talking about over the next couple of days is how to transform, how to renew our culture. So let me talk about Michael a little bit. He's got quite an interesting background. He's president of Manifold Productions, Incorporated, an independent film and television production company, which he founded in 1977. Through Manifold, he's written, directed, and produced numerous award-winning nationally broadcast documentaries, as well as corporate and educational films. His most recent film, which I think some of you have seen, Created Equal, Clarence Thomas in His Own Words. Yes. I see some of you have seen it. It's an incredibly wonderful, wonderful piece of work. It opened in movie theaters in January of 2020 and was broadcast nationally via PBS on May 18th, 2020. My wife and I were raptly sitting by the television watching it on that date. Also coming up is the Last 600 Meters, the story of the 2004 battles, Najaf and Fallujah, the two biggest battles of the war in Iraq. From June 2020 to January 2021, Michael Pack served as the first Senate-confirmed CEO of the U.S. Agency for Global Media, which oversees the government five international broadcasting networks. From 2015 to 17, he served as president and CEO of the Claremont Institute in Upland, California, publisher of the Claremont Review of Books. From 2003 to 6, Mr. Pack served as senior vice president for television programming for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. In 2002, President Bush, George W. Bush, of course, nominated and the Senate confirmed him to serve on the National Council on the Humanities, which oversees the National Endowment for the Humanities. So he spent a lot of time in the belly of the beast. He served from July 2002 to February 2005 in that position. 1993, he served as co-chair of the International TV Council of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. And previously, he was director of WorldNet, the USIA's global satellite network. He's a graduate of Yale College, the University of California at Berkeley, studied film at NYU. Before launching Manifold Productions, he worked extensively in production and post-production. He worked as a staff editor for RAI, the Italian TV network, and for Pathé News in New York. He and his wife, Gina, who is here with us tonight and who is even more energetic than he is also at Manifold Productions. They have three wonderful sons, all of whom I know and am proud to know, and reside in Chevy Chase, Maryland. So, Michael, please take it away.
Bill, thank you for that kind introduction. And I think congratulations are in order. You know, a great day for Bill and well deserved. How can you hear me? Is this, I had some mic issues? Okay, good. Well, I'm honored to give the keynote speech to launch this important conference. As Bill has said, along with my wife and business partner, Gina, the energetic one who's sitting right over there, we've been producing documentaries for many years. I started my company in 1977, as Bill mentioned. Over 15 of our films have been nationally broadcast on PBS. All won awards and garnered many favorable reviews. So, as Bill also implied, I'm a maker of culture, a practitioner, not just a critic or expert. Also, I run some major cultural institutions, serving as president of the Claremont Institute, senior vice president of television programming at the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and CEO of the U.S. Agency for Global Media, the U.S. government's international broadcasters, including the Voice of America. So I have also the perspective of a media executive. And I have watched numerous conservative efforts to take back the culture and the media over many years. So those are my bona fides. Before getting down to specifics, let me review why we are here. I'm sure these lamentable facts will be cited numerous times over the next few days. They are an important starting point. Let me move this out of the way. In the late 60s, the New Left called for a long march through the institutions, meaning the gradual subversion of the elements of civil society. The phrase is attributed to German Marxist student leader Rudi Dutschke, who was intending to echo Mao's long march. The concept was quickly picked up by the Frankfurt School and has its roots in the cultural Marxism of Antonio Gramsci. Student radicals knew they had failed to foment violent revolution in the 60s, so they turned to capturing the West's cultural institutions. Today, their success is undeniable. In the academy, in Hollywood, in tech, in woke corporations, and in the permanent government bureaucracy. Their first target was the university, where, as student radicals, they were already sitting. They quickly expanded to Hollywood. For example, Bert Schneider, one of the producers of Easy Rider, helped finance and plan Black Panther leader Huey Newton's flight to Cuba to evade charges of shooting a 17-year-old prostitute. To the Hollywood elite, Schneider was just earning his street cred. Over the years, the left has come to own the narrative. Their version of contemporary events and history dominates. We are told that the American Revolution was fought to preserve slavery. The Soviet Union collapsed on its own thanks to Gorbachev. Trans women have a civil right to compete in sports with biological women, and the rest of the woke litany. In the past, conservatives have downplayed the importance of culture, seeing its airy fictions as less serious than economics or politics. But after losing many of their children and grandchildren to the progressive left, that many have come to see the error of their ways, at least in theory. Many quote Andrew Breitbart's aphorisms that politics is downstream of culture, as if that were news. In 1820, Percy B. Shelley wrote that poets are the unacknowledged legislators of the world. And by poets, he meant all artists. Plato and Aristotle understood this thousands of years earlier. Now, you hear conservatives talking about culture and storytelling all the time, but I'm not sure they really get it. I've watched a lot of conservative films, especially documentaries. Few are really good, as I'm often told by my friends on the left, and most don't even coherently tell a story. Preaching at the audience is not telling a story. A series of anecdotes is not a story. A story is something that happens to a protagonist or group of protagonists with a beginning and middle and an end, a story arc. Characters change and develop. Ideas emerge from the action. Let me offer two examples of how story works drawn from my own films. Our documentary, Created Equal, Clarence Thomas in His Own Words, already cited by Bill, tells the story of Justice Thomas growing up in the segregated South to the Supreme Court. And we let him tell his story himself. He is the only interview, except for Ginny. He looks directly at the camera as if speaking directly to the viewer. To give you an idea, here is the trailer. Would you roll the clip, please?
Judge Thomas, you solemnly swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God.
I do.
Please be seated.
When I was six, I wandered the streets by myself. You were hungry and didn't know when you'd eat. Someplace in my life, the road split off. I'd gone to the seminary. I'd gone to all white schools. I was never going to be a part of that world. I was never going to be white. The problem is I could never go back completely to the world I came from. We're supposed to be revolutionaries. We were for anybody who's kind of in your face. I saw what I had become, lashing out at every single thing. And then I asked God that if you take anger out of my heart, I'll never hate again. And that was the beginning of the slow return to where I started.
I want my candidacy to unify our country.
I was under constant attack. You're not really black because you're not doing what we expect black people to do.
That I will nominate Judge Clarence Thomas to serve as Associate Justice of the United States Supreme Court.
That's when all heck broke loose.
Judge Thomas began to use work situations to discuss sex.
We know exactly what's going on here. This is the wrong black guy. He has to be destroyed. You really didn't matter. What mattered was what they wanted.
So you'd still like to serve on the Supreme Court?
I'd rather die than withdraw from the process. I wouldn't be able to say I lived up to my oath and did my best.
Also, I would just like to say before I continue my speech that we're all happy that Justice Thomas seems to be out of the hospital and doing well. I think so. That's really great. And I have been reminded in recent days of how the attacks on Justice Thomas and Ginni are just relentless. They simply don't stop. It's amazing that the courage that they put up with all that. So, you know, they are to be commended. We are lucky to have them. So our film deals with issues like race in America, being a black conservative, originalism, the principles of the founding, and much else. But not by experts telling us what to think, but through Clarence Thomas's life story. Viewers hear directly how he experienced these issues personally and how they impacted his life. To make a compelling story, we needed to structure the narrative, to build to the right climactic moments, employing music, editing rhythms, visual imagery, and the rest of the cinematic toolkit. Good documentary filmmakers reveal their biases not so much by distorting facts, but by the stories they choose to tell. Several progressive filmmakers have chosen to tell the Ruth Bader Ginsburg story. RBG has been graced with two documentaries and a fictional feature film. All have been widely acclaimed, and Robert Redford even invited her to Sundance, to the Sundance Film Festival, to celebrate her even more. Clarence Thomas unlikely to be invited. We chose to tell his story, and America needs both. If you want to see the entire film and our 15 or so other films, let me suggest you visit our website, manifoldproductions.com. And for the next week or so, our film is actually streaming free of charge on another website, justicethomas.com. Our film, The Last 600 Meters, tells a different kind of story, depicting the biggest battles of the Iraq War, Fallujah and Najaf, in 2004. A climax is this scene towards the end of the film, one of the most intense firefights of the war, called Hell House. Would you roll that clip too, please?
So I arrived about 20 minutes
15 minutes after this fight had begun. And it was at, I guess I would call it a bit of a stalemate. And the reason I say a stalemate is because wounded Marine inside, Staff Sergeant Chandler organizes a rescue party. They run in the room, try and shoot everything that moves so they can pull this Marine out. As soon as they run in, what do the enemy do? They're smart. They throw grenades in the room. As they walk in the room, they blow up. Now I've got two more Marines wounded. The other two wounded Marines fall into the kitchen, and they're trapped in this kitchen. So now I got four Marines trapped in the house because no one could go in this living room without getting blown up. Another rescue party goes in, led by a corporal, Corporal Wolf. Goes in with a sergeant, and they try and go in. Corporal Wolf gets shot in his flak jacket, falls on the floor. Sergeant Byron Norwood gets shot in the head, killed instantly.
Then First Sergeant Brad Castle realizes that there are men in extremis hurt. He can hear the screams. He enters the house. He grabs Marines nearby, takes them in with him, begins to develop the situation inside the house, and in the process of maneuvering to an empty room, engages and kills a man at close quarters and is wounded in the process by a enemy above him. And in fact, he and his partner, his buddy, Lance Corporal Nichols, both are stitched down their legs with AK-47 fire.
These guys are in a very good position, the enemy. There was not a very easy way to get to them. And at the same time, all of these rooms, this structure is very solid. The construction in Iraq is very sturdy. Steel rebar, reinforced concrete, and sometimes triple layer brick. You couldn't shoot a missile through some of these walls. And so we couldn't bring any heavy weapons to bear, couldn't bring any grenades to bear because we had too many of our own men wounded on the inside. So basically all we could use was our hands and our guns. So another Marine, PFC Boswood, and myself started taking this sledgehammer to the steel grate of this window.
So the lieutenant goes in without their protective vests and plates on, etc., through the bars of a window that they manage to pull aside. This all in extremis. There's firing going on. There are grenades being thrown in the house. There's groups of Marines separated and trapped by this very effective defense scheme. Grapes goes in with Boswood. They identify the threat above them. They work out a scenario to suppress the enemy above them.
We got four or five guns pointed up at these positions, and just like you'd imagine with a countdown, okay, you ready? I'm not sure. okay, well, we're gonna go on three. Make sure you don't run in front of our guns because we're going to be shooting. And the old, ready, set, go. And then we start unloading on these guys upstairs, and these two selfless Marines run across this kill zone, not once, not twice, but four times to pull Marines out of there. And we had some Marines in some pretty bad situations. Lance Corporal PFC Nickel was bleeding really bad from his leg. First Sergeant Castle was carried out by those two Marines who aren't carrying any weapons, but still holding his weapon, ready to fight. They were in bad shape. So we had to get them out of there as quickly as possible. But we still had these two guys in the house, and they weren't going anywhere. And we weren't going anywhere until the job was done.
They managed to get everybody out of the house alive, and Byron. They managed to get Sergeant Norwood out of the house.
Yeah, these guys are real heroes. I'm gratified that many senior military leaders have praised the film. For example, General Mattis, who was in charge of the First Battle of Fallujah, said this, quote, "The last 600 meters reveals the infantry's world as it has seldom been seen by those who have not experienced it. This film, uncaptivated by politics or ideology, reveals the most bruising ethical environment on Earth and the character of the young men and women that our nation sends in harm's way, its infantry. It does so without veneer or apology, and in the tumult shown, understanding builds respect for those who do our nation's bidding in the highly unforgiving environment of the last 600 meters. This film is a classic, unique in its approach, and unique in what it reveals. Those are General Mattis's words. However, the film has not yet been released. And the reason tells you a lot about how differently the left and right respond to movies and understand stories. Although the Corporation for Public Broadcasting was the principal funder, PBS rejected the finished film, the only time that has happened in my entire career. They said the film was too pro-military, too sympathetic to the young soldiers and Marines. In fact, they accused me of using selective casting to make them look more attractive and articulate, as if they needed my help. In other words, PBS did not like what they took to be its message. Next, we tried to raise money to release the film in movie theaters to generate audience buzz, leading to a good cable or streaming deal. I went around the country screening the film and meeting with wealthy donors. I was accompanied by one of our executive producers, Steve Bannon. Yes, that's Steve Bannon, then a movie guy, and clearly a great salesman. Consistently, these potential donors told us that while the film was emotionally moving, they didn't know at the end what they were supposed to think. Was it pro or anti-war? Why was there no call to action? So at that time, we failed to raise the necessary funds. Clearly, the film deals with issues like patriotism, honor, the nature of counterinsurgency warfare, and how the military functions, but through the medium of story. For our potential donors, it was not explicit enough. They were uncomfortable with the ambiguities of stories, unlike PBS. And that was part of the point of the film. War is messy, certainties vanish. We still hope to release the film. Perhaps its moment has come. With the war in Ukraine, the disaster in Afghanistan, and other worldwide threats, we need to decide how we want to wage war. It would be wise to look back at what happened last time during the biggest battle since Vietnam, Fallujah and Najaf. But what is wanted overall is not storytelling merely. Story is the beginning, not the end. The viewer's mind must be teased to see more than just a rollicking good tale through ambiguity, metaphor, and the rest. Story must be in the service of ideas. Now, not only does the left have a better intuitive grasp of story, but they are more serious about developing the institutions to support storytelling culture. Over the last 50 years, the left has poured time, money, and creativity into this project. Looking only at documentaries and small independent features, I estimate conservatively that the left spends tens of billions of dollars a year annually. For example, the budget of public broadcasting, radio and TV, is about $2.5 billion a year annually. Netflix, according to the Wall Street Journal, spent $17 billion last year on content. All this money is not going only to left-leaning product, but much of it is. On the other side, the right spends maybe tens of millions on film and television. So over 50 years, this gap has grown to hundreds of billions of dollars, which has underwritten a progressive ecosystem of supportive and reinforcing institutions, in addition to many powerful films. The left starts nurturing young filmmakers right from the beginning of their career and then at every step along the way. It starts with film schools. Virtually every college and university in America has a film school, and there are about 4,000 colleges. Almost every film school professor is a self-described progressive. I have never met a single one who calls himself or herself a conservative. Every year, these film schools graduate hundreds of thousands of progressive aspiring filmmakers and camera operators and editors and film composers, et cetera. Only a small percentage have the talent, ambition, and drive to succeed, and that small percentage becomes the basis for the next generation of progressive talent. On the right, we have no such winnowing process. we are left with the few filmmakers who fall off the left-wing apple cart. After film school, there are many training programs for progressive young filmmakers to sharpen their skills and make industry contacts. Then, when looking for their first job, they can apply to any of the vast network of progressive film companies, which range from one-man shops to divisions of major studios. When our budding young progressive filmmakers have acquired enough experience and are ready to make their first big film, they can turn to an extensive network of progressive funding sources. All the large American foundations, including the Ford Foundation, the MacArthur Foundation, and the Rockefeller Foundation, have divisions devoted to supporting social justice documentaries. The federal government itself funds documentaries through the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the National Endowment for the Humanities, and the National Science Foundation, among others. The staff of these government entities are very focused explicitly on social justice and DEI, and their grants will reflect that. For-profit funding is also available for these filmmakers. Several boutique distribution and production companies have been created by wealthy leftist billionaires, often from Silicon Valley, to support woke films, such as Participant, bankrolled by eBay founder Jeff Skoll. HBO, Showtime, Amazon, Netflix, and the other cable and streaming companies commission woke documentaries and nonfiction series in addition to acquiring them. As these young progressives start to produce their film, they can rely on a talent pool of skilled artists and craftsmen, from cameramen and composers and editors to computer graphic artists, who proudly call themselves progressive as well. When their woke film is finished, how do they make sure a large audience sees it? Well, up-and-coming progressive filmmakers have a host of options, especially among cable and streaming services. Years ago, we all hoped these new companies, like Amazon, Netflix, and Hulu, would provide a diversity of programming, would be different from the standard Hollywood fare. In fact, they are all run by the usual progressive Hollywood and New York elites, many straight out of Ivy League schools. Finally, our progressive filmmakers can enter their film in prestige film festivals like Sundance or Telluride, or the many smaller ones, including ones dedicated to environmental or LGBT or other niche markets. Then they might be lucky enough to get an award from the Oscars or the Emmys, or the many others, all run by the same woke club. Not surprisingly, with all this attention and need for content, there's been a renaissance of documentary and nonfiction programming, both feature-length documentary films and short docs. Many are of very high quality, but almost all are progressive, again, especially in choice of subject. For example, the proposed Emmy nominees for nonfiction this year included docs and series celebrating Stacey Abrams, Greta Thunberg, progressive Philadelphia DA Larry Krasner, Breonna Taylor, and the 70s black militant group MOVE, a virtual litany of woke causes and progressive heroes and victims. None of these films had voices questioning the saintly nature of their protagonists. So, after all this, the left's dominance of culture may seem daunting, but this should not deter us. To put our problem in perspective, look back at how the radical leaders felt when they began their long march through the institutions. They too were actually discouraged. Frankfurt School writers decried the hopelessly bourgeois nature of mid-century America, narcotized, according to them, by TV shows like Bonanza or Father Knows Best. How would they ever radicalize these comfortable middle-class Americans? They cried. But they persisted, and they are now rewarded by success. And we can succeed, too. A restoration is easier than a revolution. Cowards who want to surrender in the culture war often claim we can't fight back because, they say, the left is naturally more artistic and given to storytelling. Our side is more interested in politics and making money. Now, this may describe our society as it is now, but it is not a natural law. I'm not even totally sure what this assertion means. Great art and artists are hard to pigeonhole. And the politics of the past are very different from the politics of the present. Just to cite a few examples, Virgil's Aeneid, the most influential poem in human history, glorified the Roman Emperor Augustus. Dante's Divine Comedy longed for a reconstituted European-wide monarchy and a universal church. Shakespeare's history plays celebrated and justified Elizabethan rule. Whatever you call these works, they are not left-leaning, anti-authoritarian. The trope of the radical artist defying convention and society is comparatively recent, a creation of the Romantic movement with its Byronic rebel artists and its critique of industrialization and the values of the rising bourgeoisie. But over the last two centuries, there are plenty of exceptions to this Romantic myth, from Robert Frost to T.S. Eliot and many others. My part of the cultural battlefield is the movies. And the movie industry itself is the best rejoinder to the myth of leftist artistic superiority. Hollywood in its golden age, from the 20s through the 50s, consistently made movies with a patriotic subtext, selling the American dream to audiences here and all over the world. These movies celebrated faith, family, and individual opportunity. Hollywood moguls like Louis B. Mayer, Jack Warner, and Samuel Goldwyn were Jewish immigrants who fled oppression and pogroms in Eastern Europe. They prized American liberty and freedom, having bitter memories of its opposite. And of course, selling the American dream was good business, leading to immensely popular movies, since these movies mirrored the values of their countrymen. The iconic American genre is the Western, whose greatest director is John Ford and greatest star, John Wayne. Ford's movies, like The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance or The Searchers, tell complex stories of the settling of the West, basically positive with complicating features. John Wayne often portrays the hero, a rugged individualist, maybe too violent for civilization, but necessary for its success. These movies and icons like Wayne made people all over the world want to come to America and be Americans. When it comes to storytelling, in truth, the advantage is all on our side, not on the left's. Our stories, especially about America, have heroes and villains and world-changing adventures. These are stories past generations have loved hearing, and they are actually true and reflect even deeper truths. The left has had to turn all this on its head, with anti-heroes, nihilistic, postmodern Westerns, dystopian, anti-capitalist fantasies, and the rest. With the help of deep pockets and the control of all cultural institutions, they have done pretty well with a weak hand. So we may be in a culture war, but only one side is actually fighting. Their side is making culture, ours is complaining about it. Imagine a war where one side deploys troops and weapons, and the other side complains about the first group's inhumane behavior. No wonder we are losing. We haven't really begun to fight to get our troops in the field. We need to start producing culture. It can be done. To give you an idea of what can be accomplished, let me describe what my company is working on now, and we are only one small production company. Fortunately, we have a generous multi-year grant to help get us started, but naturally, we will need to aggressively fundraise to realize the grandest of our ambitions. Our plans have two parts. First, we intend to expand production. As is typical for a production company, we have many projects in development, and the list is always growing. Let me describe five from this list without too much detail. Several of our projects could be called revisionist history, aiming to retell a part of our history which the left has distorted or ignored. Our multi-part history of the environmental movement is that kind of project. From Earth Day in 1970 to today's climate change initiatives, the environmental movement has long argued against industrial capitalism, claiming it is destroying the planet. But is this true? For starters, many environmentalist predictions have proven dramatically false, such as Paul Ehrlich's claim in 1968 that a, quote, population bomb would lead to raw material shortages by the 1980s, which clearly did not come to pass. In a bigger sense, capitalism has lifted a huge number of people out of poverty, and in many cases, improved the environment. Our series will be a comprehensive look at the history of the environmental movement, crediting it with successes in clean air and water or national parks, for example, but looking at the dire consequences of its excesses, culminating in a consideration of climate change and the Green New Deal. Another revisionist history project is our series looking back on the 60s. The left has consistently made heroes out of 60s activists, beginning in the 60s itself and continuing unabated today. A recent example is Aaron Sorkin's Oscar-nominated movie, The Trial of the Chicago Seven. Even radical groups like the Weather Underground and the Black Panthers have had their hagiographies. It's time for a truthful history of this turbulent decade, which has set a lot of today's progressive agendas and is rarely, if ever, critically examined. The left's prime evidence that America is systemically racist is their charge that the police are wantonly shooting unarmed black men out of racist hate. The BLM movement used the George Floyd killing to unleash nationwide riots. But is this charge true? Was that killing and the many others like it that they cite examples of excessive force or of racism, of both or of neither? What is the real story? We will examine this history to find out, as we have in our 1999 film, The Rodney King Incident, about the first of these iconic cases, which set the pattern for what was to come. America's founding fathers are under attack today as never before, from tearing down their statues to the 1619 Project's claim that the American Revolution was mainly about protecting slavery. So this seems like a good time to re-examine our founding. We have done two previous films on founders, Rediscovering George Washington and Rediscovering Alexander Hamilton, which place their lives in the context of today's world. Next, we want to turn to Thomas Jefferson. These days, he is under attack not only for being a slave owner, but also for his Enlightenment ideas, as realized in the Declaration of Independence. We will present him warts and all. Our other biopic, and the last film I will describe, is not a documentary, but an independent feature film about young Teddy Roosevelt's adventures out west, which combines a coming-of-age story, a Western, and a historical drama. Grieving from the sudden death of his beloved wife, Teddy, a young, well-to-do Easterner, flees his native New York City to cowboy life in North Dakota, where he helps to bring law and order to the frontier and discovers in himself the stuff of American greatness. This is the kind of story that earlier generations of Americans were raised on. The second part of our new plans, which is perhaps even more necessary, is that we are dedicated to training the next generation of up-and-coming, right-of-center documentary filmmakers. For all the reasons I've explained, there are very few well-trained, talented, non-woke filmmakers who can continue this work for the next 10 or 20 years. So we are creating an incubator program to nurture this talent. We plan to begin with a big conference to gather as many young, non-woke people who are interested in film that we can find. We are currently looking for partners to join us in hosting the conference. The conference and an application process will let us winnow the field to a handful of filmmakers each year who will produce short docs under our tutelage with us serving as executive producers. These shorts will be faster turnaround videos on hot button issues, such as cancel culture, election integrity, and transgender politics in elementary schools, to just name a few. These shorts will deal with issues by finding in them the human story that reveals the essence of what is at stake, rather than being issue-oriented essays with lots of narration and explanation. The format will be closer to the New York Times' op-docs than the video essays popular on conservative websites. Although topical, these films will not be advocacy. They will be a fair presentation of the issues, featuring all sides. Through making these short films, a new generation of non-woke filmmakers will learn producing skills, narrative technique, and journalistic judgment. As my overview of the left's ecosystem indicates, these projects of ours are not enough, not nearly enough, to counter the left. We need many more production companies and all the other institutions of culture as well. A positive development, which I find encouraging, is that there are many more ways for a non-woke film to reach an audience. You can stream it from your own YouTube site. You can make a deal with one of several new conservative streaming services. And it's possible you can persuade one of the major streaming services to pick it up. After all, we at Manifold Productions have been successful for decades in getting our films nationally broadcast in prime time on PBS, hardly a right-wing outlet. The key is to have truly excellent content whose value cannot be denied. Content is indeed king. So, contrary to conventional wisdom, I am much more optimistic about the culture, especially the storytelling media, than about politics and government. Sure, we can win some elections, but the permanent bureaucracy has spent decades burrowing in and is protected by civil service rules. I have found this out by recent bitter experience, as many of you know. But anyone can make a movie. Although all the supporting institutions are on the left, entertainment remains a free market. We can build our own cultural institutions, we can nurture our own filmmakers, and make our own movies. America, it is often said, is roughly divided into thirds. One-third on the left, one-third on the right, and one-third in the middle. I believe the latter two-thirds, both of them, would welcome and support documentaries and feature films which present a positive but accurate portrait of America, reflecting traditional values without preaching and without distortion. We need to summon up the will to do it and the funding. This conference is a good start. I look forward to participating in an ongoing dialogue over the next several days. If you want to take up any issue I have brought up, please see me after, or Gina over there in the audience. Again, let me thank Bill McClay and the Philadelphia Society for inviting me to participate in this important conference, and especially Carissa, wherever she is, Ruel, who is so great in handling logistics. May this conference be a milestone in the fight to reclaim American culture. Thank you very much.
Great job, Michael. Thank you so much. This is really, I think some of the younger people in the audience, you ought to feel inspired by this and give you some ideas about what to do with your life. Going to graduate school is not the only thing to do. Creating stories that are in service to ideas. That's one way to shape the battle of ideas, as we have been discussing, and to do it with excellence, and not to do it in a way that's ideologically correct and straightened by that, but to do it with an excellence that's attentive to the complexity that's inherent in a good story. A story can be complex in a way that a proposition can't. So thank you very much for this wonderful presentation. Let's conclude with a few housekeeping announcements. Make your beds tonight. tomorrow, the annual breakfast meeting of the membership begins at 8:00 a.m. And the breakfast buffet opens at 7:30. here in Reunion EF. Please note that this is open only to current members of the society. That means spouses, prospective members, guests, fellows, students. You're on your own for breakfast. But there are lots of possibilities. The concierge can help you with that for recommendations, and although they may just direct you to their own facilities, but it's worth trying. Coffee service will begin at 9 o'clock, with the first general session starting at 9:30. And finally, there's for those of you who want to continue to socialize and imbibe adult beverages at the cash bar, we have a reserve section that will be marked private event in Mondul's on the second level. So this reserve section is for us. It's quite pleasant. Lenore and I went up there and checked it out, and we like it very much. So hope to see many of you there, Cash Bar. But thank you all for your attention. Good night.